I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 160 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. Our guest this week is a true working musician, someone who's been writing and singing songs, playing guitar, and producing for several decades, Steve Conti. He became lead guitarist in one legendary band, the New York Dolls, and co-wrote half of his latest album, The Concrete Jangle, with the frontman of another legendary band, Andy Partridge of XTC. He's also played with Paul Simon, Peter Wolf, Phoebe Snow, Willie DeVille, and many others. And he has a surprising happy story about playing lead guitar in Chuck Berry's backing band. Conti's far-ranging musical career may be unknown to some, but it contains an overload of great adventures. Dreaming of putting out vinyl records, he grew up in upstate New York, moved to New Jersey, and launched his career in Manhattan. He was songwriter-guitarist for the band Company of Wolves, which released its self-titled debut on Mercury in 1990. Later, he formed the band Crown Jewels with his brother John, a bassist with whom he still works. Steve and John Conti also launched the Hudson River Rats, a blues band that had a residency at Acme Bar and Grill in New York's West Village. Renowned drummer Bernard Purdy joined them for a while, and they played with such artists as Etta James, Charlie Musselwhite, James Cotton, Cyndi Lauper, and Carole King. Steve Conti has done lots of studio work as well. How did he step into the shoes of the late Johnny Thunders to become the New York Dolls lead guitarist when the band reformed for the 2006 album, One Day It'll Please Us to Remember Even This? What was that experience like? How did he and frontman David Johansen co-write songs? How many songs has Conti written at this point? Spoiler alert, it's a lot. Which album does he call The Reason I'm a Musician? Stevie Van Zandt's Wicked Cool label released Conti's 2021 solo album, Bronx Cheer. It includes Those Sexy Lies, a song you wish Aerosmith might have recorded over the past two decades. Earlier this year came The Concrete Jangle, also on Wicked Cool, with Andy Partridge having co-written all five Side One songs. How did the two of them connect? What was Partridge talking about when he told Conti, "You stole my dream gig"? How did their collaboration on a song such as One Last Bell work? With guitar in hand, Conti demonstrates. And what kind of input does label owner Stevie Van Zandt offer on his songs? The Concrete Jangle not only is on vinyl with a gatefold cover, but the songs 4th of July, Shoot Out the Stars, and All Tied Up have gotten lots of airplay on Little Steven's Underground Garage Sirius XM station. Is this a dream come true for Conti, or is there an asterisk? How does Conti make everything he does work as a job? He knows a ton about music, much of it experienced firsthand. I loved hearing his stories, and so will you. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Steve Conti. You're launching your solo career. You're not launching it now. Obviously, you've had a bunch of records out, but you're pursuing it sort of after having done a lot of other stuff. And so I'm also curious what that's like to just sort of be like, hey, here I am. I'm Steve Conti. I've done all the, I've been on all this other stuff you might have heard, but now here's me. What is it like pursuing a solo career right now?
First of all, in this era of music and how we can put it out there, it's very interesting. When I grew up, I had dreams of having a record deal, when I was a kid, and I started writing songs when I was 10 years old, and loved the Beatles, and that was my dream, and my goal was to have a record deal, an actual vinyl record like this Concrete Jangle record that I just put out. By the time went through all the things you do as a kid, you're playing all your high school bands and everything, and then by the time I got to New York City and got my first record deal with Company of Wolves, my rock and roll band from the late 80s, 88 I think we started, got signed in 89, put out a record in 90. There were no more actual records, it was CDs.
We got right.
A CD deal. There was still vinyl going on in Europe, but we never got a copy of our record on vinyl. It was only CDs in those stupid long boxes. Remember those?
Yeah, they're such a waste. Now people collect them. I threw all mine out, but now they're like, oh, you know, if you have the long box, it's worth more. I'm like, I never sell my stuff anyway, but it's kind of annoying. There's no, because there's like, how do you stack that? Like, there's nowhere to put them.
Oh, you know, and I mean, you got to ruin the packaging to take the CD out anyway. So it was like plastic and you had to, you know, tear it apart with your teeth.
And, right. And album art is meant to be square. Could we just agree on that? It's not meant to be a long rectangle.
No. And, you know, I prefer the, you know, I mean, I love having records designed for, you know, for the big 12-inch thing, you know, because...
No, you got the gatefold. I mean, like, this is your package isn't just some, you know, kind of quickie slapped on vinyl record that someone felt obligated to put out. This was put out with some love. You got a gatefold. You've got you pull it out and you've got the credits on the inner sleeve and
lyrics.
You know, printed on both sides, photos, gatefold, and colored vinyl. I know, it's beautiful.
So, you know, that's one of the perks of being with Little Steven's label, Wicked Cool. But I'm jumping ahead of myself. So,
no, you're not.
So I got the CD deal, you know, and then, you know, that sort of format carried on for a good, I don't know, let's see, that was 1990. So it was about another, 20 years, maybe. I mean, when did streaming really start? I guess maybe around 2007 or something like that. 1997.
Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah. All the social media stuff started around 2007, if that helps.
Yeah. So, you know, and nowadays it's pretty much streaming. You know, you make a... I mean, I continue to make records because that's what I do. I write songs and I record them. But whatever format they come out on is... you know, mostly streaming, but when I put out these physical records, it's mostly for collectors, you know, and people that love vinyl. You know, I also have vinyl singles, you know.
It's great. No, a lot more people are buying vinyl than CDs now. So it has come back. I mean, like my neighborhood record store, bookstore, it was more of a bookstore and now it's more of a record store. And it's the vinyl, you know, they bought like another storefront just to put more vinyl in it, and they do really well. So I don't think it's just collectors buying this stuff. I think that's how you're listening to it now. That's, oh, off 4th of July, there's the single.
We put out the first single with me and Andy. We put it out on sky blue vinyl, the cloudy blue vinyl.
Awesome.
But, you know, to all of a sudden, you know, come to the realization, you know, this late in life that, you know, when you were 10 years old, you thought you'd be able to like sell records and that was going to be your job. You know, it was going to be how you're going to, you know, have a career and pay your, not that, you know, I did it for the money at any time, because I would have done something else if I could have for money. Cause let's face it, it ain't a huge paying gig unless you're, you know, playing behind, you know, or in the Foo Fighters or something, you know? So yeah, that's the reality is it's a streaming sort of culture. You know, a lot of people don't want to own anything. They don't want to hold anything in their hand. They don't care. They just want to hear the music and skip around. I mean, I'm guilty of it. I listen to everything on my iPhone, you know, through a Bluetooth speaker. You know, I moved from Manhattan to the Bronx 8 years ago, and I haven't even unpacked my stereo.
Really?
And I have tons of vinyl, and I have tons of CDs. But it's a little more nuanced than that. I have a weird space that I would have to get the two speakers arranged in, and it just hasn't been a priority. But artistically and career-wise, what it's like going from doing all that stuff, you know, having, you know, records on major labels and then being with, you know, doing studio work and stuff with Squire and Peter Wolf and the Dolls and Monroe. And then, you know, I just never stopped doing my own thing.
Right.
I was always doing my own thing. I had my own band. I had a band called the Crown Jewels with my brother after a company Wolves broke up in the early 90s. We put out our own records for almost 10 years. And it's just, it was a new place to jump off from, you know, being in the Dolls. I don't know, for better or worse, you know, I all of a sudden got this following of like punk people, you know, who think of me as like some punk rock guy. When, you know, before I did, I was in the Dolls. I mean, I was like playing, you know, I was working with Paul Simon and Phoebe Snow and Peter Wolf and like, you know, more R&B and Willie DeVille and, you know, more soul and R&B and, you know, stuff where you really had to be a versatile player.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, you know, I do a 3-chord, 4-chord thing, which is great, you know, and I love it. Luckily, you know, my history is, you know, I was self-taught with Chuck Berry and the Stones and all that when I was a kid. So, you know, I could easily go back there, you know. But, you know, suddenly I have this whole new crowd. And with Monroe as well, the Hanoi Rocks people. And, you know, it's always weird, though. You think they might expect you to be more punk. So, you know, I come out with this, like, Beatley, you know, album with Andy Partridge. And I'm sure some people were scratching their heads, you know, going, what is this? But that's who I've always been. But I've always been a lot of different people.
Right. Well, it all fits. The stuff you're doing fits in that category of melodic rock, which, you know, weirdly has become, you know, as someone who grew up listening to almost all that, it's weird how sort of like niche in our, you know, culture it is now. Rock and roll is kind of this, you know, little boutique thing over here with all the hip hop and pop, you know, at the center of it. And just like even the stuff that's, you know, rock just sounds so, I mean, a lot of it. I mean, there's plenty of like good rock still being made, but the stuff that you're sort of the charts or whatever is like much more sort of processed than synthy and everything else. But on the other hand, you're in this wicked cool environment where you're putting out records and you're getting played on the radio because guess what? Like, I have Little Steven's Underground Garage and I just heard Shoot Out the Stars yesterday on it. And I hear that often. And I was hearing 4th of July on there as well. So in a way now, after so many years, you're sort of still able to live that dream of you got your gatefold vinyl record out and you can turn on the radio and hear your songs. And that's like, that's the dream, right?
Yeah. It's unfortunately for like the average person who doesn't want to pay monthly for a Sirius satellite radio, right. Those people don't know who I am, maybe, because, you know, Little Steven's Underground Garage does get played on terrestrial radio across the country and throughout the world, actually, but it's like a specialty 1-hour version.
Exactly. Yeah, they used to play that here, too.
And if you have a coolest song in the world that week, you'll get played on that. But otherwise, like the 24/7 ongoing programs on Sirius, you know, you need to pay $25 a month to hear that. But yeah, it is living the dream, and it's a bit of a, you know, it's a bubble. It's kind of like the wicked cool Underground Garage bubble. You know, it doesn't really go to the Billboard charts necessarily, you know?
Right.
But I'm happy. I love the label. I love Steven. I love the guys. You know, the promo team is great. You know, they really help out a lot with, you know, producing the vinyl. You know, I mean, I produce the records myself musically. And they have their own studio, you know, so I go to Little Steven's where he has the office and the studio, and I make the records there. I do the basic tracks there, and then I take the stuff home and do my overdubs, my vocals and guitar solos, and I bring it back there and we mix it there.
Do they give you feedback on any of the stuff? Do they, like, is there sort of like label notes and stuff, or are they really like, do what you want to do?
Oh, well, I always try and involve Steven from the beginning, but you know, he's a busy guy. So he's
right.
He's out with Springsteen, or he's like recording a live album of his own. And, you know, sometimes I've sent him, you know, stuff, here's a new batch of tunes I'm thinking of recording. And he's so busy that I just have to go ahead and do it myself and hope for the best. Hope he likes it, you know. And he's weighed in on things like, you know, a mix. He'll say, you know, try doubling the vocals here or resequence the album or whatever. But I must say, most of the time, it gets put out my way, which
right.
is nice, you know.
All right. So how did you end up connecting with Andy Partridge?
There's a guy called Dennis Fano who makes guitars. He had a company called Fano Guitars in New York. And he was repairing my guitars at a local guitar shop while he was having his own business on the side. And he told me one day that he was building a guitar for Andy, like a copy of the little nylon string guitar of his daughter's that he used to play on so many of his demos.
Huh.
And probably, you know, records too. It's probably the thing that's at the beginning of, you know, Dame Fortune or Church of Women.
It's okay.
Small body nylon string. So Dennis made him a copy of that. And I said, oh, Dennis, man, I'm a huge XTC fan, Andy Partridge fan. Will you please give him my latest record? And it was this record my brother and I had done called The Contis, Bleed Together. So Dennis sent it to Andy. He reported back that Andy really liked the record, but I don't remember if he had a label at the time, but, you know, there was no direct communication. But he became aware of me, and my it was a pretty wild, weird, eclectic record. So I think he appreciated the artistry of it. Because then later, when we actually met, first we met on Twitter, because Steve Lillywhite is a friend of mine. I met him through some various situations in New York. I actually met him at a wedding. And we played together, and I subbed for him on his radio show as a guest DJ, and I played on his radio show. And one day, Steve Lillywhite and I were chatting on Twitter, and I mentioned something about XTC, and he said, oh, well, Andy's on Twitter. We should rope him in on this conversation. Next thing you know, the three of us are chatting, and Andy says to me, you stole my dream gig. I said, what? He goes, guitarist in the New York Dolls. I never would have thought Andy Partridge would have, you know, had a dream to be the guitarist in New York Dolls. He said, when Johnny Thunders quit, he sent David Johansen a letter, you know, proclaiming his love for the band. And so,
wow.
You know, I will call myself Lord Andrew English. And, and you know, he had really long hair at that point. I guess it was like 75, probably, when Thunders and Nolan quit. Which, you know, so that never came to be, but we connected there, and then we started chatting and private messaging, and eventually I got his email. And then he found out somehow that I was going to be playing with Michael Monroe and Alice Cooper in Swindon, where he's from.
Right.
And he wrote me a note on Twitter. He was like, I hear you'll be in my shithole town. He says, I'll buy you lunch. And I was like, immediate screenshot, Andy Partridge.
Wow.
You know, and so that day, it was like one of the greatest days. I did the sound check with Monroe, came out to the parking lot. Andy and his buddy Stu Rowe, you know, from the Three Clubmen. Have you checked that project out?
Yeah.
So Stu's like his engineer, basically. Stu and Andy picked me up. We went back to Stu's shed, as they have in England, you know, and we listened to a bunch of stuff that they were doing together. And then we went into the house and we had lunch and we passed the guitar back and forth. Andy showed me how to play Scarecrow People.
It was okay.
And, you know, I was showed him some jazz licks, and we listened to some of the 5.1 stuff that he was remixing. And we just watched YouTube videos and laughed and goofed around and told jokes. And it was just like, I felt like I knew the guy my whole life, you know? And that was 2015 or... maybe it was, yeah, I'm not sure of the chronology, but anyway, we kept in touch, and I put out records, and I would send him a copy, and he would give me a really nice review and quotes I could use for my promo, which was very sweet. And then in 2019, it was post-COVID, so it was after my album Bronx Cheer, it was time for me to do something new for Wicked Cool, and I said, this would be the perfect opportunity for me to ask Andy if he'd write one song with me, a single. So I wrote, I said, would you like to write my next single with me? And he was like, well, Steve, I sort of swore off writing with other people, but it's not a no. And I was like, okay, great. So, because I had been hearing these interviews he was doing, like my failed songwriting career.
Right.
He talks about how, you know, he would write all these songs for or with other artists, and then their management or the label would put the kibosh on it and say, you know, it's too weird or whatever. I said, listen, if I write a song with you, there's no way I'm not going to put out an Andy Partridge co-write, you know, so it's not going to be a waste of your time. But I came home and I whipped up this really elaborate, like Beatly XTC demo on my, recording gear. And I sent it to him and he was like, oh, that's great, Steve, but you know what? It's too finished. He goes, why don't we start something from scratch? We'll do a Zoom. And I was like, yes.
What song did you send him?
I Dream Her.
Oh, okay. Last song on the album.
Which was not called I Dream Her then. It had no title. It had no lyrics. It just had the melody. And in fact, it didn't even have the chorus yet. It had like the verse and intro and it went somewhere else. I purposely didn't finish it, thinking he might want to join in on it. But he even thought it was too finished, too realized, So we did the first Zoom, and instead of writing just one song, we wrote four songs on the first. Wow. We didn't complete them, but we started for it. We had the germs of four songs, and that was Hey Hey Hey, Are You the One? Shoot at the Stars, I believe. Another one that didn't make the record, which is kind of Rundgren-ish, didn't really fit. And I don't remember what the fourth one was. Yeah, and then I would go away and I would make demos myself and send him the demos for comments. And he would say, oh, try this, double the chorus here, or that lyric's not quite working. And we did those four. And I sent Steven the demos. And again, he was so busy that I really didn't get a response. So I thought maybe that means he doesn't like them. So I said, Andy, let's put on our Dukes of the Stratosphere hats and get something really more psychedelic and garagey. And that's when we came up with We did another Zoom. We came up with We Like It and One Last Bell and...
4th of July?
Fourth of July was 4th of July was a hook that I had kicking around for 20 years. And I just could never get a verse that I liked. And Andy immediately knew where to go on it. So... yeah, it was that kind of really organic thing.
So when you do these co-writes, how would that work? Because you guys are on Zoom together, like you and I are right now. Would you be sitting there with your guitars? Would one of you just, would you just keep sort of plucking out like hooks until one of you says, oh, stop, let's do that? Or did lyrics come first, or how did it work?
Yeah, we'd sit there with guitars. And of course, you cannot play in sync.
Right.
On Zoom, so like one guy has to play something and the other guy plays it back to him.
So you're holding up just for the listeners at home. See, right now you're holding up what guitar? What is that?
This is a Zemitis.
It's pretty.
Yeah. Ronnie Wood used these, and James Honeyman Scott from The Pretenders.
It's like sort of silver and reflective. It's pretty cool. Just so people can picture it. And it's got this kind of vintagey thing going on with sort of that pattern. Oh, look at that.
Got like a tin front.
Yeah, it looks like a tin front, right.
Really beautiful designs. There's this Greek guy, Tony Zemitis, who passed away, and they've redone the company, and they're made in Japan now, but really well-made, beautiful guitars.
So you'd sit there with your Zemitis or some other guitar,
I think we both had acoustics. And we had, every tune sort of had a different method. So I knew I wasn't going to show up at the first Andy Partridge writing session empty-handed. So I brought an idea, and he brought an idea. And the first thing he said was, I think I let him, because I was probably a little nervous, I let him bring up the first song. So he said, I've got this idea for this like Syd Barrett kind of riff. It's like... And then he started saying, hey, hey, hey. And, he had the sort of beginning pretty realized.
Nice.
And we wrote the bridge together, and then we went back and forth on the lyrics. He had something about a gun in there, the one with the gun. I said, Andy, I'm in America. I really don't want to write about guns, with all the gun violence here. So I said, the one set to stun.
There you go.
That was his first contribution. And then I brought the Todd Rundgren-ish one in, which we finished. It was called The Theory of Attraction, which might be on my next one. But and then after we worked on the two that we had brought in, he was like, all right, What else you got? You got any titles? And I'd throw out some titles, and he liked Shoot Out the Stars. I was like, oh yeah, we can do something with that. So he just, you know, the way he is, he writes very visually, not so much on that song, but I think he just started, you know, playing. He had some melody ideas, and then I added the stars that shine. I added the second part, and then I wrote the chorus, and he helped tweak the lyrics, and it went like that. Then he said, what's the song that you wish you had written? I said, King Midas in Reverse by the Hollies.
Good one.
And he was like, ooh, okay. And he played, for some reason, he played an F chord. I've never written a song in F in my life. With an open G there, right? And he goes, ooh, sounds like a bell. And he says, well, it should be a nursery rhyme. This is all coming out of his head, just spur of the moment. One last bell is ringing out. Boom, the song, you know, was born. And I wrote the bridge. Look down for your final trip. But use your grip. Wait a minute, the town is burning down. But, you know, I always thought it was very Towers of London.
Right.
And at one point I went, no, don't do that. So. But that, you know, that's kind of how it went. And then,
and you've got those nice horns in there, which sort of have that regal feeling to it as well, which,
yeah. So, you know, that's the way he writes. He said, it sounds like a bell. And then he came up with the bell concept. And then I started trying to think like him, cause he's an artist, visual artist, a painter, you know, cartoonist. And I started picturing all these things. I started picturing like Notre Dame, and I added these lyrics about Quasimodo, and I thought, he's going to hate that. He loved it. I was like, sometimes I would add these crazy lyrics, and I'd think, he's not going to go for it. And he loved the weirder my stuff was, the better. So, you know, I tried to get on that wavelength of thinking visually. But it's really natural for him, and it's not so natural for me, but...
Having listened to his music for so long, all those XTC records, what surprised you the most once you got inside that songwriting process with him?
You know, he's not a god, you know, none of us are, but, you know, you look up to your heroes and you go, oh my God, you know, he's, everything he writes is absolute genius. But, you know, there were times where I go, nah, Andy, no, that's not good. I don't like that. But, you know, that was like 1% of the time. You know, almost everything he did was really great. And you know, a lot of what I put forth, I'm sure he thought was shit too. But you know, he's a human, and I got to see his process sometimes. Like, there was one point where he busted my balls for rhyming with the same word.
Right.
I mean, I don't remember what the word was, but you know, one line ended with, say, you know, moon, and the next line ended with moon too. And he was like, you can't do that. And then, you know, a couple songs later, he did the same thing. And I went, Andy, come on.
Right.
So he's like, ah, shit. But
part of what's fascinating about this too is that, you know, in XTC, you really got the sense that he was, you know, doing his own thing. And especially on those later records, you hear those fuzzy warbles, because of course I have the complete fuzzy warbles on top of everything else, and they've released so many demos and things, and it's like his demos and arrangements going into the studio were so complete already that it was like he sort of needed less and less input from everyone else. Yet since XTC's been gone, he's co-writing with people like you or Robin Hitchcock. And that's not something, like, it wasn't like he and Colin Moulding were writing this way. Like, they did their own songs. So it's interesting that he's now doing that with you when he didn't do it with his own bandmates.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about the dynamic between them, except, you know, I know that they all live in the same town now in Swindon, and they don't really see each other.
Right.
That says anything, but you know, I'm sure there's a certain dynamic there from, you know, going back years and years, decades, you know. But I think it's a way for him to keep his foot in, you know, like songwriting, because he's not really putting out his own records now.
Right.
And I guess it keeps him active and exercising that part of his brain. And I'm sure he's got a million tunes still inside of him that are great, and maybe some that we haven't even heard. There might be a Fuzzy Warbles volume 365 somewhere. But also the Robin Hitchcock record, I listened to that recently, and I started chatting with Robin. I actually met him at a festival, and we chatted about Andy a little bit, and I just sent him the record. I sent him a link to the record on Twitter, I think. Private message, because he follows me now. And you know, I've been trying to get a hold of him, maybe write a song with Robin too. And you know, it's beautiful that it's kind of opened up all these doors. You know,
Right.
Dave Gregory, Dave was going to play on my record, and then I sort of ran out of money, and I thought, well, you know, I can play guitar, so I'll just do it myself. But I was thinking of Dave orchestrating it, you know, and maybe doing a string arrangement for what song, Decomposing.
Right.
I mean, maybe
That's
play.
one that could be, an XTC song, but you did that one all on your own.
Yeah, that's one of my. Yeah, some people would write me and go, "Oh, I know that decompose. I'm decomposing a song for you. I know that's one of your Andy covers." Like, no, it's
No.
not. That's me. And I'm even playing piano on it and strings. I did the string arrangement myself, you know, because Dave was like, string arrangements can be very costly and take a long time. So I got a little discouraged, but I want to. I just love him, and in the future, I think I'll would love to do something with him.
And you had Prairie Prince as your drummer, who
Oh, yeah.
played on Skylarking. So was that like a, and some other stuff later. I think he was on some of the Apple Venus as well. Was that a conscious,
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, because, well, I have been trying to get a hold of him anyway, and as it turns out, we have tons of mutual friends. Kasim Sultan, of course, from because he plays with Todd, with Rundgren, Prairie does, and so does Kasim for years since Utopia. But when I reached out to Prairie, when I finally got a hold of him, he was like, "Oh yeah, I know who you are. You know the Dolls and Monroe." And I was like, "Oh shit, okay, he knows who I am." And I said, "I'd love to, you know." I said, "I've written these songs with Andy." That was my kind of, you know, pitch to him. It's like, I've written five songs with Andy Partridge or eight songs actually at that point that I thought I was going to use for the record. And I said, I'd love to have you play on it. And we were talking about me flying out to San Francisco where his studio is, or me just sending him my demos and having him play out there. And I said, man, I really want to play in the room with you. You know, can I
Right.
fly you to New York? So I flew him to New York and he played with me and my brother, which was great. And he said, and the clincher was, "I'll bring the Earn Enough for Us snare drum." Yes! Because, you know, that's one of my favorite tracks of all time.
Sure, absolutely.
When I first got Skylarking, I remember sitting in my brother's car. We had it on cassette and we put it on and we had to pull over to the side of the road and rewound the tape 12 times to listen to that song 12 times in a row.
Wow. One of the great side two openers.
Oh my God, just unbelievable. So, you know, yeah, when Perry said he had that snare, I was like, all right, and we used that snare for everything.
Carol Pop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. Revolution's great offerings include the classic Anti-Hero IPA, the non-alcoholic sparkling hop water Super Zero, and the premium lager Cold Time. No matter the weather, Cold Time hits the spot. It's an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, a touch of German hops, and pure Great Lakes water. It's never pasteurized, and the brewed low and slow badge on the can attests to a lower temperature fermentation that mellows the beer for a smoother, more flavorful sip. Your previous album was Bronx Cheer from 2021. Though Sexy Lies, to me, sounds like a classic hit single from, you know, pick your earlier decade. You know, when you put that record out, did you think, oh, this is like commercial, or is it, again, just sort of like at this point, this is just what you do, and it's not sort of a matter of what the market is anymore?
No, I mean, you know, if I had to do what the market was, I'd be making a hip hop record, but I don't do that. So, you know, I just do what I've always done. I write melodies and I play guitar and I like to rock out. And, you know, there are some beautiful, like soulful ballads on there, like Flying and
right.
Guilty, you know. So my goal with that record, usually what I do is I have a handful of core songs and I just try and fill it in with other things that feel like they would go with it. I don't necessarily go away and write 30 new songs and then come back and pick the best 10. I think with that record, it was, I don't remember which was the, what was the core of that tune. I think maybe Wildwood Moon. There was like a lot of older songs on that record. Guilty is from the 90s. Flying is also from the 90s. Liar Like You is, I wrote that hook when I was 15 years old.
That's one of the punkier ones.
Yeah. So, you know, it was like kind of a New York punk soul record. You know, I picked other songs that I thought of, newer songs that, or I wrote newer songs that I thought would go with it. Wildwood Moon was like kind of poppy, but almost, in my mind, almost Springsteen-ish in a way. I even had the little Glockenspiel on there.
There you go.
And yeah, Sexy Lies was, I always thought it was more like an Alice Cooper or Aerosmith kind of.
When I heard it, I thought, yeah. I mean, I remember hearing it. I think that one was getting played on, you know, the Underground Garage too.
Yeah,
that was one that I heard originally on the radio, and then heard it on your record, and it was sort of like, oh, this is like the song that Aerosmith should have been recording over the last three decades.
Yeah, I mean, I love Aerosmith, but I stopped listening to them at a certain point. You know, I think Pump was maybe the last, for me, the last great Aerosmith album. But, you know, I just love Get Your Wings and Rocks and Toy Sure. Attic. That's three, boom. You know, I think every band has their, like, run of three. You know, the Let It Bleed, you know, Beggar's Banquet, Sticky Fingers, you know, or the Revolver, Rubber Soul, White Album, or Pepper, rather.
Right.
You know, and that was theirs. XTC, for me, is Skylark, Drums and Wires, Black Sea,
English Settlement.
English Settlement. Yeah.
So those three are three, and then they sort of, and then I would skip again to Skylarking.
Yeah, I skip Mummer.
Yeah, Mummer and Big Express are okay. No offense, but
oh, no.
The one that picked it back up for me was 25 O'Clock. I loved that. I played that EP so much more than I did Big Express, and then Skylarking right after that, and then Sonic Sunspot and Oranges and Lemons, and like those four together.
Yeah.
I mean, None Such is no slouch either. It's a little long, but.
I mean, every record has just genius moments on it. But, you know, Drums and Wires, I also don't love That Is the Way It's Done, you know, the Collins song. It's not one of my favorites. But, you know, I would still, you know, just for, you know, Nigel, Reel by Reel, Helicopter, and.
Right.
You know, I can't think of that.
When You Near Me, I Have Difficulty.
Yeah. My 5-year-old sings that in the car with me.
Yeah.
You know,
that's one of those where it's like you sort of forget if you're not really thinking about it, and then it comes on, you're like, oh, wait, that one's really good too. So 10 Feet Tall.
Yeah. And of course, Life Begins at the Hop. But really, you know, when I was in college, I remember my dorm, I was in a dorm, and my dorm mates, or whatever you want to, would call them, would play XTC records. I was listening to jazz. I was going to school and like studying bebop. You know, I was listening to Wes Montgomery and Charlie Parker and John Coltrane. And I would come back to my dorm and go, "What is this noise? What do you call it?"
Right, I was going to say.
And, you know, like the drums were so crashy, and I didn't get it. I didn't get Black Sea, and I didn't get Drums and Wires at first. And then my college radio DJ, Matt Pinfield, you know who he is?
I don't.
Matt Pinfield, 120 Minutes MTV, bald guy. Okay. He's a pretty big celeb these days. He was the DJ, and he played Melt the Guns. And I stopped in my tracks, and I went, "What is this?" And he said, "That's XTC, English Settlement." I ran down the store, bought it. And from that moment, I loved everything on that record. And then I went back, and I listened to Black Sea. I went, "What was I thinking? This is genius." Then I went back and listened to Drums and Wires. "This is amazing too." And from that moment, I was all in.
There you go. Little knowing that you'd be co-writing with the guy.
Yeah. You know, life is crazy. You know, hey, one of the first pop records that came into my house was Bookends by Simon and Garfunkel. And then I end up working with Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel.
Wow. Yeah. Mobile Fidelity just put out a new vinyl edition of Bookends, which I just heard. Sounds great. It's such a weird record. Like it's like these amazing singles on it. And it also has like Save the Life of My Child, which I remember just putting that on. And like one of my daughters was like, "What is this?" I'm just like, "Oh, it's Simon and Garfunkel."
I think that's like one of the first Moog synthesizer tracks.
Yeah, it's true. Before Abbey Road, yeah.
Yeah,
Abbey
before, Road, I think of that. Before Maxwell Silver Hammer and all that. And
What was the first record you ever bought with your own money, by the way?
You know, I'm always trying to remember this. I'll tell you the first two records that I ever got for my 9th birthday. I got Beatles 65.
Good one.
Which had been out for a few years already at that point. And the Stones, the Stop Sign shaped Through the Past Darkly.
Okay.
Like a greatest hits with Honky Tonk Woman put on it to sell the record, because that was their latest single. Mick Taylor just joined. So, you know, Beatles and Stones, right away, there was my musical schizophrenia was born right then and there. You know, people say, "Well, you're a Beatles fan or a Stones fan?" I'm like, "I'm both. Why do I have to choose?" You
know, right.
The dirty blues of the Stones, and I love the melody of the Beatles. But with my own money, it was either Chuck Berry's Golden Decade or Jay Giles' Bloodshot.
Well, there you go.
A huge Jay Giles fan.
Do you remember the first album that you obsessed over?
Revolver. In fact, Revolver.
And that was you kind of coming back to it, because you would have been, what, like 6 when it came out?
Yeah, Revolver is the reason that I'm a musician. Yeah. When, you know, because when you're a kid, you know, you hear what's around you and your records your parents play. And my parents were playing, you know, Nancy Wilson and Wes Montgomery and Ella Fitzgerald and Johnny Smith, all these like jazz records and big Sinatra and Tony Bennett. And then, you know, when we'd be in the car, I'd hear pop music on the radio. But I really wasn't paying attention until one night my parents brought over this young couple who were slightly hipper, and they brought Revolver over, and they put this record on, and I just remember staring at the cover, you know, which, you know, trying to pick out, is that Paul? No, he looks different here. And, you know, the spaghetti hair strands, you know, and listening to it with headphones and the stuff flying around in the headphones that Tomorrow Never Knows. I was like,
right,
that's it. I'm doing this. And for some reason, I wanted to be Ringo. So I was a drummer first. The next year, I had pieces of a drum kit, and I was taking drum lessons. I had a practice pad and a snare and a hi-hat. I didn't have like a full kit yet. But I was a drummer from age 7 till I picked, and my brother was a guitar player until 10 or 11 years old. I picked up my brother's guitar and realized I could write songs not knowing what I was doing. And I thought, I can't be stuck behind a drum kit if I'm going to write songs and sing. And so I started taking guitar lessons and zoomed past my brother. And then he said, "Hey, screw this, I'll switch to bass." And now he's, you know, one of the greatest bass players in New York City. And
plays on your record. So you guys are still collaborating after all these years?
So, Revolver was the first album I obsessed over, and especially the Lennon songs, especially She Said, She Said, and Tomorrow Never Knows.
So you had to get the British import, because then you're like, wait a minute, they left off three Lennon records from the American one. That's what's up with that?
I never even knew that, because I had also got Yesterday and Today, which was basically, you know, some of maybe Beatles for Sale.
It was like little bits of Help, Revolver, and Rubber Soul sort of snipped off along with like some singles like Day Tripper and We Can Work It Out.
Yeah. You know, and then the Beatle album started coming into the house. You know, we got the White Album, Pepper, and I don't think we were buying any other records. I did get, I remember early on hearing, you know, Carrie Ann by the Hollies, loving that. I Can See for Miles by The Who, HQ Park by the Small Faces. Like, I just keep coming back to, like, there's like five songs that really, that were on the radio at that time around 67.
British.
Yeah, British imports that just went right into my brain.
Do you remember the first song you wrote?
Yep. It was called Strawberry Flowers in May.
Oh, I love it.
And I didn't, you know, like I said, I was a drummer. And
he's pulling out the guitar, people.
I didn't know how to play. I didn't have a pick, so I played with my fingernail, and I just would play bass lines on the... Can't remember the words, but that was basically it. And from there, I took lessons and was able to use the other five strings.
There you go. Do you have any idea of how many songs you've written over the years?
Thousands.
Do you write all the time? I mean, like, are you someone who writes for projects, or are you just writing?
I mean, I have, you know, my phone is full of ideas. I sing into my phone. And this is just since iPhones, you know. I write lyrics into my notepad and my phone, but before that, it was all this.
It's pulling out notebooks.
Notebooks and cassettes. Piled to the ceiling, you know. 90-minute cassettes full of ideas. I mean, I will probably never, before I die, get a chance to go back through all of these things and find... But I'm sure there's some gems in there, but, you know, I tend to, like, move on. Or if I'm really, you know, the ones that stick in my head, like the reason Flying and Guilty and Liar Like You and songs like that from the Bronx Shear album ended up on there is because there's just some that you never forget. You don't have to go back and, like, leaf through books and go, well, what was good? You know, I just never, if you don't forget a song from 20, 30 years ago, it must be good.
You spent a lot of time playing in New York. You're in the Hudson River Rats with your brother, and it sounds like a lot of cool people you backed or just played with. Who among them were you maybe most awestruck to play with? And I don't know, what'd you get out of all those different, you know, encounters?
Oh, the list is long. I mean, we had a steady gig at this club called the Under Acme. There was a soul food restaurant called Acme Bar and Grill. It was like Louisiana food, Cajun food. And downstairs was this club, you know, typical black box, you know, long rectangular shape with a decent stage. And we just started playing, and we had the guy who put the night together. It was called Blues Night. And the criteria was, we would have, you know, guests, our band would play Hudson River Rats, we'd play a set, and then we'd bring up guests. And the guests would come and rehearse with us in the afternoon. And the criteria was, it had to be a blues. Whatever you did, had to be a 12-bar blues. I mean, sometimes we maybe do like a, you know, a gospel-y, you know, Please Send Me Someone to Love or something like that. But basically, it had to be soulful blues. And, you know, we had Phoebe Snow would come down all the time and just blow everybody away with that voice. Cyndi Lauper came down. Julian didn't sing, but David Clayton Thomas from Blood, Sweat, and Tears, because I had played with Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Actually, the band was the core rhythm section of Blood, Sweat, and Tears at that time. we had been touring together, and David Johansen came as Buster. Willie DeVille came, who I'd later work with.
Is that how you met David?
No, I mean, well, you know, I guess I met him, but, you know, that was 1988, and I didn't meet him again until 2004. So it's not like we knew each other or anything. And Willie DeVille, I toured with in 2003, so he didn't remember. He was pretty messed up at that point. I think they had to give him the hook to get off the stage. Mm. Reese Wynans from Stevie Ray Vaughan's keyboard player, he would come down and play with us. It was just, it was an amazing list.
Even heard that Bernard Purdy was playing with you guys?
Yeah, Bernard Purdy actually joined the band at one point. You know, the only drummer that I've ever played with where I had to just stop playing and dance on stage. Now, if anybody knows me, I don't dance. But Bernard was playing and I just couldn't help myself. I turned my volume down and I just went for it. Yeah, amazing drummer. But yeah, that's the kind of level of people that came down. We became a bit of a local, you know, legend there, and that led to studio work and led to, you know, kind of getting a reputation in New York, because that was pretty much 2 years after I moved to Manhattan. I moved there in 86. That was 88.
Where'd you grow up again?
I'm from upstate New York, like Utica area, Mohawk Valley, and then moved to Mattawan, New Jersey, which is about 50 minutes outside of, I live in Buffalo too. Went to a suburb of Buffalo called Gettysville. I was upstate until I was about 9. And then that's where I heard all the great stuff on the radio. We had a great station up there called WKBW in Buffalo. And then moved to New Jersey, 50 minutes outside of Manhattan, where I would hear all the other great stuff on the radio, and you know, the Zeppelins and the Aerosmiths and all that. So, and then I moved to Manhattan in 86 after, you know, going to high school and college in New Jersey.
Nice. And you played with Chuck Berry at some point too, right?
Yeah, that was 88. We had the same band that was the Hudson River Rats without our front man, because our front man was a harmonica player. So we had the guitar, bass, drums, and keyboards, backup Chuck. The promoter was a friend. We had worked with, my brother and I had worked with this promoter. He was a trumpet player at the Meadowlands. He would be the guy who would do, you know, track for the horse races. But he was a great jazz trumpet player, and we played gigs with my mom. My mom's a jazz vocalist, and so I grew up playing with my mom. That's like sort of my connection with jazz. My mom sort of raised my brother and I to play in her band. So, you know, we were already playing rock and roll, but we had to kind of learn about jazz standards and all those fancy chords and being able to change keys and segues on a, you know, drop on a dime. But this trumpet player, Frankie Rendell, his name was, he was booking the entertainment at the track. And Chuck Berry was booked, and it was his job to get a band. So he called me and my brother up, and he said, you guys want to play with Chuck? I said, hell yeah. And so I said, we'll just use our blues band. And he picked up Chuck from the airport, and Chuck goes, who's my band tonight? And Frankie goes, oh, Chuck, it's a great band. Conti Brothers, John on bass, Steve on guitar. Guitar? I don't use no other guitar player. And Frankie says, oh, don't worry, Chuck. Steve's great. You know, he can lay back. Chuck says, I'll give him one song. If he ain't happening, I'm going to throw him off the stage. So, and Frankie tells me this before we go on. And I'm like, oh, shit, okay. I guess I'm going to hang back. And so I lay, you know, Chuck comes in the dressing room. We're all there, and we're all and the movie had just come out with Keith Richards.
Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll.
Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll. We watched that religiously. Anyway, even before, you know, knowing we were going to play with Chuck, we loved the movie and watched it a million times. And then we just really bared down on it when we knew we were going to play with Chuck to just sort of get the feel of what it was like to work with him. And we said, yeah, Chuck, we're really looking forward to playing this music, you know, like the original, you know, feel of your, you know, half swing. And he's like, no, man, don't do that. He goes, that was Steve Jordan's idea or Keith's idea. He goes, bass player, watch my neck. If I do something, that's how I want you to play. Drummer, watch my foot for the cutoffs. And he goes, and listen to the lyrics. If it wasn't for the lyrics, we'd be playing the same song all night. And then, you know, I laid back the first five songs, and all of a sudden he does a slow blues. It Hurts Me Too. Jimmy Reed. It Hurts Me Too. Comes to the solo. He points at me. I'm like, shit, I thought he was going to throw me off the stage. Now he's giving me a solo. I play a blues solo. He says to in the mic, can the man play? The man can play. Take another one.
Nice.
And yeah, I was freaking. And then we do a bunch more Chuck songs, you know, O'Carroll, Sweet Little 16, whatever. Does another slow blues. Does the same thing. Gives me the solo. Can the man play? Take another one. Then at the beginning of Johnny Be Good, which is the first song, first guitar solo I ever learned, right? You know, I mean, probably every kid, but you know.
Right.
So he goes, the very first is high E string pops. And I'm like, what is going to happen when we get to the middle and that iconic middle solo happens, right? Well, wouldn't you know it? He goes, da-na-na-na-na-na, Johnny Be Good, points to me. There I am playing the first guitar solo I ever learned with the man.
You knew it.
I knew it, of course. I actually have this on film. I've never posted it. I have a DVD of it. Someone had one of those old school VHS tape cameras in the audience. They filmed it. They sent me it. I transferred it to DVD. At some point, I'm going to cut them up into individual songs and post them. But you could see my face. The smile is so wide, it looks like my face is going to crack. I smile so much, my face would crack in two.
I'm so glad to hear a happy Chuck Berry song, a Chuck Berry story.
Yeah.
Because, you know, with his pickup bands, you kind of never knew how they were going to get treated and how it was going to work out. But it sounds like you guys had a great night.
Oh, it was really great. And, you know, what a character. I mean, he invited people up on the stage, as he always does, for the last song. I think it was Rock and Roll Music, maybe. I don't remember what. And I remember he kept looking at us and smiling and saying something. And we're like, fuck, Chuck, he probably loves this. He gets these crappy pickup bands. Finally, he's got, you know, a band that can play this stuff the way it was meant to be played. What's he saying to us? Is he telling us how much he digs it? And we finally figure out, we can read his lips, and he's going, five more minutes, and we're out of here. And then he just disappears. We're still playing. He puts his guitar in a case, has a hot blonde at the side of the stage, you know, arm in arm. They walk off to his Cadillac, and that was it.
Nice.
I didn't even bring my Chuck Berry records for him to autograph, which I kind of regret.
You were being his peer, so, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's even better. You know, you have a video of him, you film of you playing on stage with him. That's better than an autograph. Joining the New York Dolls, like, how did that happen? And did you feel pressure, like, hey, I'm the guitarist in the New York Dolls?
No, because I hadn't been a Dolls fan. You know, I mean, there are, you know, rabid Dolls fans and Thunders fans, you know, and probably some people, when they saw I got the gig, what's he doing with the gig? He's not a Thunders fan, you know. But, you know, I approached it like, when I listened, I heard Thunders as being Chuck Berry, Keith Richards turned up to 10, you know. So, and I just tried to approach lead playing with maximum balls like that. And that was what I did. To kind of stay in the ballpark. But David Johansen got my number from a number of guitar players in New York. I guess it all started, you know, back at the Under Acme gig with the blues gig, you know, where all these people all of a sudden knew who I was and started calling me for recording sessions and gigs. And, you know, you just, I always say, you stay in this, you hang around this crazy town long enough, you know, something happens. And you know, you have a good reputation, a reputation as a dependable guy and a good player, your name gets passed around. So David had asked a couple of respected players like Jimmy Vivino from the Conan show, and Larry Saltzman, another guitar player who's playing in his band, the Harry Smiths. David had this acoustic blues thing. He said, I'm gonna put the dolls together. Who should I call? And everybody said the same thing. Conti, don't call anybody else. He's got the right hair, the right nose, the right guitars, the right amps. And so David called me and we met for lunch. We just talked, we didn't play any music. And after after the lunch, he pulled out a manila envelope and said, I took the liberty of making some CDs and charts for you. You want to do this gig or what? And it was just going to be one gig. It was going to be the Royal Festival Hall in London with a gig that Morrissey was putting together, the Meltdown Festival. And I said, sure, yeah, let's do it. And it was Sylvain Sylvain, Arthur Kane, you know, three-fifths of the original Dolls. It was amazing. We did, you know, only stuff from their first two albums and some covers, like some girl group covers and stuff. And, but, you know, like I said, I approached it like, how would I, you know, being that, you know, I was into Jeff Beck and Jimmy Page and Hendrix, and I wanted to be a player, you know, I didn't, a garage rock guy that played, you know, the same kind of blues scale over every chord wasn't my thing. But I thought, that's how I'm going to approach it. I'm going to be, you know, Keith meets Chuck with, you know, Wild Man volume.
So you really viewed it as like, this is a really good gig, but not like, oh, this is like my dream come true or something.
No, but I mean, how many bands, especially when you're a New Yorker, how many bands can you just step into where, you know, the guitar, the legendary, it's a legendary band.
Right.
And the guitar player is dead and they're reforming, you know. I mean, there's really nobody else in that category, right? So
how did you and David Johansen co-write for that?
Well, also I must say that when I was a kid, you know, I used to read, there was a magazine called Rock Scene Magazine, and they would cover, it was post Dolls. It was like Heartbreakers and Criminals. Sylvain had the Criminals. Johnny had the Heartbreakers. David was already doing his solo thing. And this magazine would show, you know, photos from, you know, Max's and CBGB's. And I was too young to go into Manhattan to see these things. But, you know, I was well aware of who everybody was. And that was part of my fantasy. It was like, I got to get to New York and I got to, you know, do that. This is a legendary band, of course. I'm going to do it. And, you know, I dug into it like I do with any project that I get called for. I try and embody the, you know, the vibe of what it is. And, you know, I guess I did okay because I did four albums in 6 years and toured the world with them.
Right. So, and you co-wrote some songs with David. How did that work?
Yeah. So, you know, the first year, it was pretty much like the greatest hits tour. You know, we went around the world. I mean, we went to Japan, we went to all over Europe, France and England, and of course, and Italy, Spain. And at one point, David says, hey, guys, I think we should do an album. Send me some ideas. So I sent him a CD of like 20 potential, you know, no real finished songs, but potential ideas. And I didn't hear from him for ages. And actually I was playing gigs with him with his Harry Smith's band, the acoustic blues thing, and he would pick me up in his car, whatever it was, a Volvo or something, and, you know, station wagon, and I'd throw my acoustic guitar in the back and we'd drive out to Long Island or whatever. And this is like after 2 months of not hearing anything from him, he picked me up one day for one of these gigs and we were driving, and he's like, Stevie, I wrote some lyrics to one of your tunes. I was like, oh, really? Which one? He says, it's the one you called Starving for Love. It's now called Punishing World. I went, oh, man, that's genius. Great. So much better than what I had, of course. So, you know, that was he would come up with these genius lyrics and either, you know, mostly to my melody. You know, I always had a melody. I didn't just give him chord progressions. So that's kind of the way it went. Also, Gotta Get Away from Tommy. I had that, you know, I had the whole. And then I also had and he added his own words and story, and it was great. But that was the approach. You know, I'd give him music and melody, and he'd come up with some kind of ingenious twist on, you know, some kind of dark, weird, you know, poetry.
Right. And then how did you get connected to Steve Van Zandt?
When I was growing up in Mattawan, New Jersey, where we moved to after Buffalo, I started going to school with Steven's cousins. And they would always tell me about him. And then he was Miami Steve back then, you know.
Right.
Steve was just coming out. I had never met him until, so I was aware of him. And when the Dolls played at, he asked the Dolls to play his New Year's Eve, Little Steven's Underground Garage New Year's Eve party from Times Square in New York. It was 2005, 2004 into 2005. I met him for the first time. We chatted. He asked me about, because I had just been playing with Willie DeVille. He asked me, how's Willie, blah, blah, blah. And I tried to get him my record. I had Steve Conte and the Crazy Truth album. And I don't know if he ever listened to it, but he somehow got a hold of my 2014 album, Steve Conte NYC. And his wife actually was playing it around the house, his wife Maureen. And he walked into the room and said, "Who's this?" She said, "That's Steve Conte." "Steve Conte? Who knew?" So, you know, that's, and then that record he made, my song OK DJ became the coolest song in the world. And then my next record, I did a covers record, International Cover Up. Somebody's going to get their head kicked in tonight. He made that a coolest song in the world. And then he said, let's do a single. And I did Gimme Gimme Rockaway. That was 2017. And then in 2019, he kind of revamped Wicked Cool Records, because he hadn't really been putting out albums. And he said, let's do a full length. And Bronx Cheer came out. And then COVID happened, of course. I didn't even really get to tour on Bronx Cheer at all. I played one gig. That's basically how we met. And we keep in touch, and I recorded at his studio. Actually, my band rehearsed there. He came up and he said, "I want to produce your show." So he came up when we had a rehearsal, and he's like, "Let's try this segue." And he's giving me all sorts of, you know, ideas for live show stuff, and you know, some good ideas that we kept. But he's a busy guy, man.
Yeah,
talented guy, real, you know. Between the radio station and, you know, his acting career and, you know, the studio, and he's got this Teach Rock thing where he's, you know, teaches rock history in schools to, you know, bring attention to music, to, you know, today's youth. You know, he does great things.
Right. Yeah. No, I love his little mini lessons on the show too. His little history nuggets. So what do you have coming up? You have looks like you have a couple tour dates in October on the East Coast. Like what's the next thing?
Yeah, I have a new band, and we have some shows. We have you know, I don't have a job. So my day job is playing music with other people, for better or worse.
You're in the gig economy.
Yeah, you know, you have to do a lot of different things. You know, I mean, between my own gigs and songwriting and royalties and live gigs with Monroe and session work, you know, I piece together a living.
Nice. I love the fact that, you know, you have like this cool, wicked cool record that's out that I really enjoy, and with great stories behind it. But you're also, you know, a working musician, and it's like this is what musicians do. It's not about like being the rock star. It's about, you know, you're doing the thing that you love, but you got to work. That's part, the working part of working musician.
Yeah, I mean, I know a lot of guys that just have day jobs and they don't, they play music for the love of playing music and they do something else for money. I never had anything else that I was good at that I could actually make a living at. So, you know, between sessions of singing and playing for other people, writing, live gigs, teaching occasionally, it all comes together.
That's it for episode 160 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Steve Conti for sharing his wide range of musical knowledge and experience with us. Go to steveconti.music.com to learn more about him and his music. And you can order signed copies of The Concrete Jangle and Bronx Cheer on vinyl and CD. If you like catchy rock music, give this stuff a listen. Also, you have till noon Eastern Time, December 20th, that's Friday, to vote for the songs All Tied Up and Shoot Out the Stars as 2024's coolest song of the universe in Little Steven's Underground Garage. Go to undergroundgarage.com to vote. Follow Conti on Blue Sky and Twitter X at SteveContiNYC. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Swake, and we like it. If you'd like to support us as this year comes to a close, we'd be very appreciative. Go to carolpop.com and you can give $24 or whatever you'd like. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Carroll. Please follow Carol Pop on Blue Sky, Instagram, and Twitter X at Carol Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Carroll at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Carol Pop conversation. Thanks.